Good morning, everybody. I would like to welcome you to the Joint Education Policy and Education Finance Committee informational hearing. This is the third in the series that we've had. Our first one, we heard from students and parents and organizations helping students outside the classroom. Our second one, we heard from teachers and school support staff, like social workers, school counselors, and our bus drivers. And with this one, we're going to hear from the other educational organizations, so our school boards, our superintendents, administrators, and nutrition staff. So with that, I would like to turn it over to Chair Dabney for a quick welcome, and then we'll move on.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you, Chair Joachim, for this opportunity, and thank you for organizing this series of hearings. It's good to hear voices of different stakeholders, parents, students, teachers, administrators, and others, as we explore as a body and as these two committees, how did we do this spring in the response to the COVID-19 pandemic? And how do we then think about the fall opportunities for school for students? So I'm looking forward to the testimony today. The last two hearings were rich with information and insight, and I'm anticipating more of the same today. So thank you all very much for coming to testify today. Thank you, committee members, for being here as well. And of course, thank you to staff for all the work that they're doing behind the scenes to make this hearing happen. Thank you, Chair Joachim.
Yes, thank you all for being here and all the education organizations for coordinating your testimony and the time limit so that we can run efficiently and hear as many voices at the table as possible in this next hour and a half. With that, I will kick it off with one of my own superintendents from St. Louis Park, Superintendent Aston Osai. Could you please state your name for the record and proceed?
Good morning. My name is Aston Osai, Superintendent of St. Louis Park Public Schools, and I just want to start off by thanking you, Chair Joachim, and the members of the House Education Policy and House Education Finance Committees for creating this opportunity to receive multiple perspectives from across the state about the experience with distance learning this spring and some thoughts or considerations as we move forward into the 2020-2021 school year. And I would like to first start off by just sharing a few of the key takeaways that we had in St. Louis Park from a distance learning survey that we conducted with our students and families. And I would begin by saying that in many respects, our distance learning experience was, and you've probably heard this example before, but very similar to the story of Goldilocks and the Three Bears, right? We were able to, for many families, create a distance learning experience that was just right. For some, we weren't providing enough from a instructional standpoint, and for others, it was too much. And throughout that process, we really worked to continue to refine what it was that we were offering our students and our families so that we were meeting the needs of every student that we served. But some of the key takeaways from our distance learning experience were, one, that connections matter most. So one of the things we were really intentional about starting out from the beginning was making sure that our teachers were staying engaged with their students, not necessarily related to instruction, but about related to relationship, recognizing all of the transition that our students were experiencing. Something else that came through from our students was the desire to have authentic feedback. They were working really hard, turning in a lot of assignments, and weren't always getting the type of feedback that they felt was warranted based on the effort that they provided. Students also really, and our families really, desired the need for social opportunities. So one of the things as we move forward that we're going to be thinking about is creating more synchronous learning opportunities that allow for small group work and partner work, as opposed to many of the asynchronous opportunities that we provided in the distance learning format in the spring. And, you know, families really desire the consistency in the different student learning platforms that we use. But one of the last pieces that I want to highlight from key learnings as we move into this school year is the need for us as an organization to make sure that regardless of the format or scenario in which that we're providing instruction, that we're making sure that students are receiving a standards-based experience, recognizing that standards are the floor of what our students should be experiencing, and that if we're ever going to, you know, change, eliminate the gaps that exist in our schools, that we got to make sure our students are all receiving a similar educational experience. And for us in St. Louis Park, thankfully, you know, because we have a local capital operating levy, we were able to make sure that any student student that needed access to technology had access to technology, but I can't help to think about other school districts across the state that don't have access to local capital levies and aren't able to provide resources the way that we were able to do, because that would have only have complicated the situation of being able to provide distance learning for our students this spring. And as we've been working over the past several weeks to prepare for the upcoming school year, one of the things that continues to be a challenge for us as we think about each scenario is the hybrid option. And it's not that we as a task force, which our current task force is comprised of approximately 40 teachers, staff members, and community members throughout the district. And what we continue to find is that it's not that we can't think of creative or adaptive ways to facilitate learning in a hybrid model, but our challenge is really related to some of the technical components to implementing these creative and innovative ideas, things that sometimes people don't even think about as it relates to learning, like transportation. You know, in the hybrid model that we would do half days and things like that, it becomes challenging in a situation where we already have such limited resources for transportation, not only financial, but human resources, as, you know, bus organizations and companies are having a hard time continuing to keep their staffing levels where they need to be. And thinking about social distancing and an increased number of buses that we'll need to have. So as we've been thinking about this, some things that would be helpful as we move forward would be to create systems or that would allow school districts to give families options about either opting in or opting out transportation. We route every single child, but many kids are dropped off, or some kids at our secondary level drive. And if we could have a cleaner idea of the actual number of students that would be on buses in the fall, that would allow us to use our resources to the fullest capacity and not adding additional resources that we may not need. Another piece is that, you know, in most school districts in St. Louis Park is no different. We share transportation with non-public schools in some instances, and creating other ways so that non-public schools could get their students to and from school would give us additional space if we were to have to enter into a hybrid model, or if we're in the face-to-face model and we needed to social distance appropriately on school buses. So what I want to end with is just I certainly know all of my superintendent colleagues across the state fully understand that with each scenario there are implications that are both positive and negative, and essentially there's no a perfect solution. But as we move forward, one of the things that would be very helpful to us here in St. Louis Park is to know as soon as possible. And I know that the Minnesota Department of Education and the Minnesota Department of Health are working extremely hard to get information to us by July 27th. But the sooner we can know, the sooner we can focus in our attention on one particular scenario, as opposed to planning for three different scenarios where we may interact with, you know, one or two of them or just one of them. So I would encourage this governing body to really support and help us in gathering this information and in being able to make a decision as soon as possible so that local school districts can do the necessary planning with their stakeholders to move the work forward. So thank you for taking the time to listen, and I hope you have a great day.
Thank you, Superintendent. I also want to thank you for all the work you did. I know you didn't start out as a one-to-one school, and even though distance learning didn't necessarily mean the technology, I'm glad you did recognize your digital divide and were able to overcome it. And thank you for acknowledging that some districts might not have had the opportunity. So thank you. And members, I forgot to have Mr. Peterson read the names of those in attendance. So Mr. Peterson.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you, Chair Joachim. We also have Chair Dabney, who has also said some words this morning. Both Vice Chairs Kunesh-Podein and Vice Chair Sandstad are with us. We have our leads, Representative Erickson and Representative Kreisha, with us. We also have Representative Barr, Representative Baker, Representative Bennett, Representative Bierman, Representative Christensen, Representative Daniels, Representative Damath, Representative Grunhagen, Representative Hassan, Representative Hewitt, Representative Jordan, Representative Juergens, Representative Katiza-Watoon, Representative Marquardt, Representative Nornes, Representative Pryor, Representative Sandell, Representative Scott, and Representative Wozelik with us this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Next up, we have Superintendent Tim Lutz from Bemidji Area Schools, and thank you for joining us. I had the chance to visit your school district last summer, and I know that you have a challenge with busing to begin with, so I'm anxious to hear your testimony. Superintendent Lutz, will you please introduce yourself for the record and proceed?
Thank you, Chair Joachim. Yes, my name is Tim Lutz, Superintendent of Bemidji Area Schools, and yes, busing is something I'll be talking about in just a little bit here this morning. I also would like to thank you for this opportunity to share my testimony this morning. I've been very proud of how the Bemidji School District has moved into distance learning this spring. While it was challenging and certainly not as ideal as learning in a face-to-face environment, we were able to provide a solid education to our students. We learned that students missed their teachers and teachers missed their students. Students need to be in school, where consistency is provided and social supports and nutritious meals as well as instruction. As we moved into summer, we've been successfully implementing programming, but our numbers have been lower due to the need for physical distancing and because of constraints on our facilities. And I see our work this summer as a good takeaway, good opportunity to learn as a trial run for how things may be this fall if we bring students back into our classrooms. Now, I'm an educator, and so as an educator, I wish for nothing more than to be able to bring our students back into our buildings this fall. Having said that, I must recognize that I'm not a healthcare specialist, so I will defer to the experts regarding what this fall will look like in our schools. But it's my hope that policymakers will recognize that the state of Minnesota is very large. While some areas have been hotspots for the coronavirus, other areas have very few cases of COVID-19. It's my hope that policymakers will recognize that a one-size-fits-all approach may not be the best solution. School districts in areas where the coronavirus has affected large numbers may need to open with a hybrid or a distance learning model, while schools in other parts of the state may be able to provide a safe brick-and-mortar learning environment. In Bemidji, we're preparing for each of the three scenarios as instructed by the Department of Education. We're designing plans that meet guidelines for social and physical distancing in classrooms and on buses, and we're making adjustments to how we'll deliver meals in school. Whatever the scenario, transportation will be a huge undertaking with a district of 825 square miles and 74 buses every day. We may need to hire additional staff to monitor social and physical distancing on those buses, and perhaps to take the temperatures of students as they enter our buses. In addition, our population of students on IEPs is around 20%, and we are committed to providing an equitable education to each of those students. We also have a large population of underserved students from three American Indian communities in our vicinity, and we plan to provide equitable educational access and opportunities to every one of them. We've got our work cut out for us, and we'll be spending the entire summer working on the logistics. In addition, access to broadband and devices is also an issue for many in our district, and we've worked tirelessly to provide such access to every family that has needed them. These are all going to add large expenses to our budget. It's our hope that additional funding will become available because our budget will not survive another year of this pandemic, even with CARES dollars coming in. Special education, transportation, student support services will be needed more than ever during the next school year, and we'll need the financial support to provide these services. Finally, in closing, I hope that policymakers will allow school districts to make local decisions about schedules, calendars, and curriculum. The landscape of education will look very different this fall than ever before, and what school districts need more than anything is support in the form of funding, autonomy, and professional trust. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Superintendent Lutz. Next up, we have Superintendent Lewandowski from Intermediate District 287, and I know you're in the full swing of distance summer school right now as well. Will you please state your name for the record and proceed?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Sandy Lewandowski. I'm the superintendent of Intermediate District 287. And for committee members who may not be familiar with the intermediates, our intermediate serves 11 suburban, west suburban school districts. And we typically serve the top 1% of students who have the highest needs. And indeed, Madam Chair, we are in extended school year format on distance learning and continued that from the regular school year. What has helped us in District 287 is that we have for many years run Northern Star Online, which is a statewide online learning program. And so that prior experience positioned us well to serve our in-school students, particularly those in our Setting 4 special education programs and our Area Learning Center. But the unique needs of our students still presented very significant challenges. Our experience and that has helped us is that of creating a trauma-sensitive school district and emphasis on racially equitable opportunities, access, and experiences for students and families. Prior to the pandemic, those same priorities were all part of our strategic plan. And it has been well documented and reported that the pandemic is having a disproportionate impact on students and families of color. Further, it has been clear that our need to respond to trauma of our students is facing us this fall. Fortunately, our district again has been prepared, but we believe that our focus on district-wide improvement was on the right track, and it's going to be especially critical no matter what option we return to in at the end of the summer. A few results from our parent and staff survey found that over 91% of our families rated our communication about distance learning to be the highest possible, but only 35% of the families responded that distance learning was going great and that we shouldn't change anything. The majority of our teachers told us they had regular live contact with students, which was our number one priority to make that social contact. Finally, our attendance did improve over the course of the distance learning period, and in April, we had about a 90% attendance rate. Staff put a great deal of energy into connecting with families and students. We had multiple staff people connecting with individual students in many of our cases. The challenges we found was that families are looking for more ways for their students to connect socially and academically. Our staff believe that mental illness is seen as the number one barrier to learning for our students, followed by our ability to provide them effective instruction and trauma-sensitive care. In terms of what our staff think about returning to school, it's important to recognize that health and safety is their number one priority, and that is particularly a priority because of the unique learning needs of our students and the high rate of one-to-one contact that is critically necessary to be in an in-person type of model. Our staff report that students were doing academic work about 1 to 2 hours per day. And it reflects a limited amount of academic engagement. And so, as with other superintendents, you will hear that the benefits of distance learning would be higher if we went to one of the other two models, certainly. Some of our big takeaways is that trauma-informed practices and racial equity will continue to be in the center of our work, and social connections between students and staff is another crucial aspect of our work. Unless we can connect with our students, we will not be able to provide for either their well-being or their instructional gains. And of that, the families of color will be the most disproportionately impacted. And it is critically important that our approach to understanding and supporting our students has to be trauma-sensitive and healing-centered. And that, for us, is where we need to start. In conclusion, we believe that while implementing distance learning for students in our district was challenging, we've learned valuable lessons to help us in the future. However, to adequately meet the needs of our students as we go forward, we have to continue professional development for our staff in that trauma area, and we're responding adequately to the mental health needs of our students, especially with racially conscious mental health providers. This will take additional funding streams that we currently do not have. And if we are to advance any of the three options for fall planning, these needs will be present. I would urge the committee to acknowledge and fund trauma and mental health needs of our students, because without that, students simply cannot take full advantage of instruction. And we know from brain science, this is true and a critical part for us as educators in our field to recognize that. Again, kids of color are suffering the most, and they are coming back with probably significantly more trauma than what they left with as a result of the pandemic and the killing of George Floyd. Thank you for this opportunity to listen about the unique learners within our educational system. And I look forward to working with the department and the committee on any changes that help us get students back in school and adjust to their new set of needs. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Superintendent Lindowski. I want to announce that we have Representative Hearn Edelson joining us. And next up, we have Sharice Jones, from principal from Global Arts Plus St. Paul Schools. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Good morning, everyone. Again, I'm Sharice Jones, principal of Global Arts Plus in District 625. And thank you so much for having me. My program is a pre-K-8 program where it consists of programming for DCD scholars, Language Academy. We have our hub for our physically impaired scholars for St. Paul, as well as early childhood special ed inclusion classrooms. As principal, it has been such a challenge to make sure that all the groups represented in my school have access and have engagement. And I will say that the teachers have done a remarkable job in their efforts and commitment for doing so. Though it came with some challenges, and realistically, our groups, we were not able to engage them as fully and address their physical academic needs as one would hope. And that is something that really needs to be addressed as we move into the fall as well. We know that information was ever changing. The departments in our district were very much available, but we don't know what we don't know. As best as they did, we were able to access them, our different departments, to support our needs, and we thank them for that. It was very key. Communication was very key for me as a building principal, for staff, toward staff, for our scholars, as well as communication for our families. I mentioned earlier that we are a Language Academy school, and with Language Academy, we have a vast number of languages that represent our student body and our families. And the limitation for the turnaround of communication was challenging. Being able to reach and communicate with our families in a timely manner was challenging. Having the appropriate, we did our best. We scraped from within and outside, and that is something also to take note of. Our teachers were very innovative in how we engaged with our families and our scholars. Many of our teachers really enjoyed the more synchronous teaching because it's that they're there, they're giving of themselves, they're present and in real time. And that is the ultimate goal. That's who thought teaching would be a lonely job with what we're dealing with now. With regards to staff, we had great opportunities. There were wins with our paraprofessionals that we utilized. All of our staff were engaged, and it was important that I took care of our staff and created opportunities for staff to take care of each other. It was a different energy. It was a different use of time, and it was important that important for me to release teachers from the overwhelming pressure of being able to produce or provide for our families. We had a limited amount of time. we had to make some decisions that were going to kind of take some things off of our plates. And that is something that is very hard for teachers because they really want to be all that they can be for our scholars. Balancing time, and then dealing with trauma. We already were dealing with trauma prior to distance learning, and then the murder of George Floyd added to that trauma. I'm thankful for our counseling department who provided many tools for our staff as well as families, but the trauma is real. The emotional exhaustion is real, and there is going to be a lot said for healing as we think about the fall. We are waiting for our district's decision on whether or not we'll be considering more of the hybrid model for school opening in the fall. But that is, I hope they do take into consideration maybe the volunteering of teachers that would prefer to do distance learning versus in the classroom. I'm concerned about the workload that will entail for teachers. They will do it if it is what they have to do. But as a principal, it's really important that I help teachers get out of their own way, help support teachers, and create that space where they can be as their most productive selves as possible. I think access is also something that we wrestle with the supports around special education, the supports around the different languages for our EL scholars and Language Academy, and then the equity work for all of our groups, our Black and Brown scholars. I will say that we were able to continue racial equity work and use of protocols during our time during distance learning, but we need more. Thank you so much. I appreciate the time that you've given to listen. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Principal Johnson. Thank you for coordinating so well with your teachers and utilizing your paraprofessionals during distance learning. Next up, we have School Board Member Katie Weiss from the Pipestone Area School. Please state your name for the record.
Good morning, Chairs. My name is Katie Weiss. I am on my fourth year as a board member at the Pipestone Area School District. I'm also a graduate of the district and live in Pipestone. I have three children in our district, fourth, seventh, and 10th graders. We are a small community with a majority of our population farming or working with agriculture in some form. We are approximately 5 miles from the South Dakota border. COVID-19 cases in our county have been very low. We have only had about 16 positives to date and zero deaths, and many of those are no longer active cases. I was asked to touch on a couple different things, budget impacts that we've had in our district. We spent approximately $8,000 for additional cleaning products and some PPE. Depending on what the school looks like in the fall, we estimate expenditures of $50,000 for additional PPE and cleaning supplies and things that we would need to make the environment safe. Transportation costs are also a concern for us if we go to the hybrid model. As far as technology, we are a one-to-one district, so devices were readily available to each student. We did spend approximately $125,000 annually for this so that we can have everyone one-to-one. When distance learning started, we did have students at home that did not have internet, so we did spend approximately $20,000 on hotspots and other technology needs. We also had additional costs for graduation. We did have it recorded and live streamed so that our students and families could all attend. As far as staffing, when COVID-19 started, we had 5 staff who had health issues that made them a risk to be in school. We have another 6 to 8 staff who are making claims and asking for accommodations that are difficult to meet. At this time, we are planning on having negotiations committee meeting with bargaining units to discuss sick leave, co-curricular compensation, and modified schedules for the upcoming school year. We are very concerned about the social and mental effect COVID-19 and the quarantine has had on our community, staff, and students. We expect an additional counseling need as well as increased behavioral issues when we return in the fall. We also have seen test scores declining, especially in our K through three students. We all know this is a target age for reading and math development, so we see additional staffing needed for student support in the fall. As far as families and the community, our parents and community want our kids physically back in school. We have not had anyone say that they do not feel comfortable sending their kids back, but we've heard lots of people saying they want their kids back in school. Our major concern is the amount of parents talking about enrolling their kids out of state and out of district. This can easily be done because two South Dakota districts have buses coming in and around bordering towns in our district. We do not want to lose these students out of the district, as this will have long-term effects on our budget, and I worry that we won't be able to get these students back once the restrictions are lifted. As a parent, school board, and community member, I hope to be able to get our kids back to school this fall. I don't feel distance learning is fair to our students' education, and it's detrimental to their emotional development. I urge you to let each district make their decisions based on being able to provide a safe learning environment for their kids. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to share our challenges.
Thank you, School Board Member Weiss. Next up, we have School Board Member David Boone from Robbinsdale Area School.
Thank you, Chairs and other members, for your time this morning. I am David Boone, and I've been a school board director for 5.5 years, and I'm currently the chair of the Robbinsdale Area School Board. On a side note, I'm also a veteran educator of 27 years and currently teach in the Edina Public School System. Robbinsdale Area Schools and all districts face multiple challenges in regards to balancing a budget with constraints. Increased technology needs, meeting student needs and staffing requirements, related openings, reopening schools under the continuing COVID-19 pandemic. Robbinsdale Area Schools is a first-ring suburb and has approximately 12,500 students. We are a racially and economically diverse district. Our district is 54% free and reduced lunch, and some of our schools have over 70% free and reduced lunch students. We have 2 high schools, 3 middle schools, and 11 elementary schools. In regards to budget challenges, I'd like to highlight 3 areas of greatest concern. Number 1 is the lack of full state special education funding. This existed prior to the pandemic and has been exaggerated during the last few months. In light of COVID-19, we anticipate that many students will return to school with additional needs, and as a result, our district will have greater special education expenses. For example, additional staff will be needed to complete evaluations and execute the IEPs, all under social distancing guidelines. Number 2, PPE for all students and staff. As we surveyed our district, there was a strong support to return to school if proper CDC safety calls protocols are followed. 82% of our families, 89% of our students surveyed in grades 6 through 12, and 71% of our staff want to be back in school at least part-time, thus the need for PPE. PPE for special education, center-based classrooms and students will be critical. Shields, masks, protective eye gear, foot coverings, body capes and coverings, gloves, hand sanitizer and wipes will all need to be procured. And third, depending on the return to school model, whether it be in full or hybrid model, Robbinsdale estimates there will be a minimum of a 50% increase in routes to comply with social distancing guidelines. And that would equate to a minimum $5.6 million increase in our transportation costs alone. In regards to technology, our district struggled with and continues to look for solutions for broadband access and bandwidth concerns, even after purchasing multiple hotspots. We are not fully one-to-one in our district. We need funding for more Chromebooks, iPads, and specialized devices for students with special needs. Parents of medically fragile students have indicated they will not send their students to school without a vaccine, which will require remote access for staff and students. Robbinsdale estimates an additional $1.15 million to adequately fund the technology needs in our district. In regards to staffing needs, we lost revenue as we were unable to collect parent fees for childcare of essential workers. And without restorative funding, we'll have to lay off employees as some districts did do. As of self-quarantining guidelines, we expect longer periods of staff absences, and we will need increased funding for substitute teachers and staff. Robbinsdale has been a leader in social, emotional, and trauma-informed teaching and learning. And in fact, our superintendent has testified several times at the legislature. We know there will also be increased needs for the social, emotional well-being of our students, and the need for school-linked mental health therapists will be critical after the impacts of both the COVID-19 pandemic and the pandemic of systemic racism. Thank you for your time today, and we are grateful for your ongoing support of public education in the state of Minnesota.
Thank you, School Board Member Boone, and thank you for highlighting the needs the schools will be having around PPE. I know that's a very big concern to make sure our schools are safe. Next up, we have Wendy Webster. She's the Director of Community Ed from St. Anthony New Brighton School.
Good morning, Chair Joachim, Chair Dabney, and committee members. Thank you for this opportunity. My name is Wendy Webster. I serve as the Director of Community Education and Communications for the St. Anthony New Brighton School District. I also serve as the Legislative Chair for the Minnesota Community Education Association, and it's a pleasure to be with you today. Just wanted to share a historical perspective from my colleagues in Community Ed, and Mr. Boone certainly highlighted some aspects of this a few minutes ago, but when school closure went into effect on March 15th, community education programs across Minnesota closed all of their programs. And we did this to follow the guidance and also to prepare to provide emergency childcare. In those cases, community education lost revenue from essentially March 15th to the end of the school year. That was for not only were we refunding people who had reserved our facilities, we were also refunding families who had paid for in advance for preschool, ECP classes, and we also halted payments for childcare programs that we are no longer able to provide. Another aspect of that is that only 8% of community education programs in Minnesota, or 26 school districts in the state, had a community fund balance of $500,000 or more. And so you think about 92% of community programs didn't have a great enough fund balance to rely on. And in some cases, school districts didn't have fund balances in which community staff could remain paid as well. Mr. Boone highlighted that a number of community staff were laid off across the state. Our district in St. Anthony, we were very fortunate. We were one of those 26 districts. We were able to keep our staff employed. However, after July 1st, that will look like a different scenario. I wanted to share three things. One, the impact of distance learning on community ed. Two, how we see this as a workforce issue for our parents. And three, just to highlight community ed's financial structure. So overall, our colleagues in community across the state do report some success with online ABE classes, ECP classes, youth and adult online enrichment classes. And I know here in St. Anthony, one of the things that I was most proud of is that while we refunded all of our ECP and preschool families their fees, our preschool and ECP teachers continue to provide distance learning in both of our half day, all day, and our weekly ECP classes. Our preschool and ECP teachers also made it a point to support parents. When I listened to Principal Jones speak about supporting teachers, I think about how important we thought it was to also reach out and make sure that parents felt connected during a scary, uncertain time. However, distance learning in early childhood and preschool was very difficult. As we know, community education across Minnesota provides most of the preschool and early childhood programming in districts. And for both of our all-day and half-day programs, parents rely on those programs for childcare and to help get kids ready for kindergarten. And it was difficult to charge families when we were not able to provide those services. So not only were we able to collect the fees, we didn't have the fees to pay staff. And therefore we had to rely on fund balances or other district funding if available, or had to rely on layoffs. We do see this as a workforce issue. Families rely on community education programs to be the reliable provider of childcare for their preschool and school age care children so that they can continue to work. Even when parents were working from home, they were contacting us asking when we would reopen so they would have a place for their kids to be so that they could continue working and being productive as an employee. One of the things I wanted to point out to both committees today is that community education has successfully implemented youth programs this summer in school districts across Minnesota. And I know Superintendent Lutz had shared that it's really a pilot site for what school could look like, what in-person school could look like in the fall. I believe social interaction and play is important for kids. And I also believe that parents want to make the best decisions for their kids as well. Our summer programs throughout Minnesota are not only following the Minnesota Department of Health and MDE guidelines for youth programs, but we are also conducting daily health screening, taking temperatures of both staff and kids. All of our staff are wearing masks. We are running a 1-to-9 ratio. So one staff is with 9 children throughout the day. So that children can remain in pods for contact tracing purposes, excuse me. In addition, as committee members, you may have already, but you will receive an outline of our procedures so you can see the different procedures that we have implemented in our summer programs. And you will also receive an invite to tour our summer programs from one of your local school districts so that you can see what this looks like in person. My last point I want to make is that community financial structure is stretched. As I mentioned before, our departments rely on fees to pay staff. Approximately 80% of our annual community education budgets are fees. And we lost about 25% of our revenue from those fees during the school closure from March to the end of the school year. Again, districts that had a community education or employed, and we are very intentional in trying to keep people off of our unemployment insurance here in Minnesota. For our summer programs, we did in fact have to raise our fees on families who are utilizing our summer programs. Typically, we operate on a 1-to-15 ratio for our school age care programs. This summer, we're operating on a 1-to-9 ratio. Our programs do have wait lists. The model that we have implemented this summer, a year ago in St. Anthony, we would be able to serve 120 kids a day. This year, we're able to serve 72 kids a day. And as we look at the school year, regardless of the model that is implemented in school districts, families will need childcare, regardless of the model. And one of the asks that I do have is that I ask that the guidance for our classroom ratios for in-person school also be used for our school age care ratios to help reduce the financial burden to families. When we talk about the potential of having up to 12 students in a classroom, and right now we're able to have 9, even that difference can certainly help make a difference in the fees that we'll need to charge families come fall. So thank you for this opportunity to share our experience in community ed, and we look forward to a great school year.
Thank you, Ms. Webster. Sorry, folks, we're starting to get a little bit behind, so folks could stay within their time limit. That'd be great. But thank you, Ms. Webster, for giving us the voice of community ed and for all your work. Next up, we have Brenton Lexfall, who's the Food Service Director for Red Wing Public Schools.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Brenton Lexfall, and I'm the Food Service Director for Red Wing Public School. First, I wanted to say how proud I am of my Red Wing Food Service colleagues. They pulled together and delivered a very successful program, and I am truly proud of during these unprecedented times. I couldn't have done it without you, and I have always believed that if you take care of the employees will take care of you. The team at Red Wing has done that, and I thank you for it. I've been the director at Red Wing Public Schools for the past 6 years, and I'm a board-certified registered dietitian with a degree as a chef from the Le Cordon Bleu. This is a new position for me as I've taken on the role of the public policy and legislation chair for the Minnesota School of Nutrition, which was once held by Noah Atlas. This year will be full of challenges and many changes, but as my team in Red Wing has shown me this past spring, that together we will rise above and show our communities the level of care and commitment we have for our families. Currently, food service directors across Minnesota are busy putting together basic structures for the 3 different models proposed by MDE. This includes putting together simplified cycle menus mirroring the summer food service program meal pattern that includes both hot and cold options for students. Some schools are looking into pre-ordering systems and platforms or simply using Google Docs to gather this information. Consensus across the board is grab-and-go style of meals with limited or no self-service options, i.e. the elimination of salad bars. When reviewing equipment, many of the districts are not moving forward with purchasing equipment due to the unknown direction and product availability, given a small turnaround window for product procurement. Some programs have invested in barcode scanners, moving away from keypads to limit possible points of transmission. Depending on the scenarios, some schools may need to purchase coolers or warmers to ensure food safety. Other considerations are on staff PPE and signage promoting social distancing if the cafeterias are used in any capacity. Additionally, programs have relooked at existing equipment to reduce and reserve capital, given the unknown that found new and interesting ways to better utilize existing equipment. Sites may purchase new equipment to be able to provide individually wrapped items as well due to the lack of product availability programs experienced this spring and are still experiencing. Staffing for many districts is a big concern. Districts report concerns about having enough staff to prepare food for both in-school children and for those children in the community, essentially running two programs to reach two separate groups of customers. Some schools may not serve enough meals to justify current labor and will be making tough choices in laying off or furloughing staff. Some of these decisions may hit schools with various free and reduced populations harder than others. Consensus across programs are encouraging the cafeteria to be open for selection and having the children dine in the classroom. Schools not having enough labor to deliver to classrooms is the driving factor for cafeteria selection with classroom dining. If I can leave you with a thought, because it is a thought on my and many of my colleagues' mind, that in time that will need to be answered. The question is, when you have run a program for so long that is free, and possibly free into the coming school year, how will you then expect to charge for this service in the future? COVID-19 has given us a unique opportunity to explore new options that can better promote school nutrition programs and get back to feeding our children. Thank you for your time, and I look forward to answering any questions you may have to the best of my ability.
Thank you, Mr. Lexfold, especially for your unique look into the trouble with logistics for the coming school year and for just wanting to feed kids. I appreciate that. And next off, we have Sabrina Williams. She's the Executive Director from Excel Academy for Higher Learning in Brooklyn Park.
Hello. Hi, just wanted to make sure I was unmuted. Hello, everyone, and good morning. Good morning. I'm so excited to be here, and I am just so thankful for this opportunity to speak to you, and now everything with my technology is starting to go wrong, but I will go ahead with my talk. Thank you again, and good morning. Thank you for this opportunity. My name is Sabrina Williams. I am the founder and executive director of the most excellent high-quality public school in the state of Minnesota, and I'm sure the nation, Excel Academy for Higher Learning Charter School in Brooklyn Park, Minnesota. Excel Academy serves over 450, almost 500 pre-K through eighth graders and have been serving college aspiring students since 2001. Yes, we are entering into our 20th year. We have a very diverse population of students, including over 95% of students of color, 92% of our students are eligible for free and reduced meals, and over 35% of our students are 35% of our students are English language learners, and over 16% of our students are special education students. This spring, we provided and distributed over 7,000 meals to our students and the community. We provided childcare for essential workers and also our distance learning program. We're continuing our distance learning program this summer, as well as many other charter schools. So I'm most honored to speak to you today on the behalf of 167 charter schools and the amazing 63,000 plus students who attend these schools, which is about 7% of all public school students in our great state of Minnesota. Charters have always been super innovative and creative. We have learned how to use the limited resources we have very well. However, in order to continue to provide high quality, equitable education for our students during this unprecedented pandemic moving forward, I would like to share with you some issues and challenges we're going to need your support in to ensure all of our students
and their families throughout the state are served well. Two of the most important issues include technology and broadband access. You've heard some of these things from other districts as well. Ensuring broadband access across the state to all schools in order to provide high quality instruction and learning. Many of our families in urban and the rural areas have had challenges in accessing technology and or reliable internet access. It's too expensive for families that can access it, and some rural areas cannot gain the access. Technology support and training for our families and the adults at home with students, as well as the students themselves, is also an issue. Transportation. Now, this one I'm very passionate about, and I've heard some of you speak on this. This is one of the biggest challenges that many charter schools like Excel Academy will face, and some larger districts, I'm sure. And I believe this will be the determining factor in whether or not we can actually offer on-site educational services at any level. With over 80% of our students depending on school transportation, how will schools be able to transport them to school safely and at the lowest risk? Some of our buses have over 50 to 60 students riding one bus, three in a seat, 10 to 15 students at one bus stop. Some of the health risk factors, which I'm sure you can imagine, are social physical distancing at the bus stops themselves, physical distancing on the buses. How many buses will be needed to transport students safely? Who's going to pay for the transportation for so many buses needed? Is there enough capacity from the transportation companies with a driver shortage and even a plan for something like this? Even having 3-week rotations for student groups, the cost, the logistics, and most importantly, the safety of our students are at risk. This will not be an issue where, for some schools, where most of the parents are able to provide transportation for students. But for many of our schools, this is obviously an equity issue, and we need your help addressing this. Other important issues, very important issues that we would like more guidance and financial support on include special education, of course, and other specialized educational support services that better serve students in person than online. Social emotional support for low and unstable emotional energy and physical and mental exhaustion that some students, parents, and staff and administration are experiencing during this pandemic, and the impact of the effects on these that they're having on everyone being able to navigate through these tough times and through various scenarios of education and still provide high quality services for our student, which is our number one priority. And there are issues related to this, including video shame for our students, online mental and physical stresses for students, their parents, staff. And then there are some who are not technically competent, some of our parents, and learning new technology platforms and self-care. And then there's professional learning, of course, for our staff, development ongoing from MDE, learning for teachers and staff. And we appreciate all that's been done, but we feel that there's more that need to be addressed. Learning from all of these new guidelines, policies, procedures, high quality online instruction. We don't want to just provide instruction to our students, but if it's going to be online, we want it high quality. Our students deserve the best. And then managing the online time. How much is too time? What is considered enough? Our staff need training and development and learning in these areas, serving students with different variety of needs online. How are we going to catch students up? Training for designated contact tracers. That's something I'm really concerned about, because I think it's important and we need to think about that. And then navigating through 3 educational models schools have been given. For the hybrid model, Excel would need to have 3 groups of students rotating 1 week at a time. At the same time, we'll need to distribute meals to students on the distance learning schedule, as well as childcare for children of essential workers. So all of these things are going to be happening at the same time. There's space.
Ms. Williams, I'm so sorry. You're a little over 5 minutes and we want to wrap it up and have some other people speak.
Yes, I will. Thank you. I timed it at 3, but 8 went on a little longer. But these are different models that we definitely want more support. And I will say that MDE has provided the guidelines that they've been able to. Again, PPE is another issue. And last, I will end it here. As someone else said, communication. We need to know where we're going to start so that we can provide high quality service for our students. Our students are number one. Thank you so much for your time, for listening to our concerns. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Executive Director Williams. I so appreciate your voice at the table and for running us through all the work that you're doing in your school and your concerns for catching students up. Next up, we have the Chair of the Non-Public Education Council, Tim Benz.
Thank you, Chair Joachim and members of the committee. Very pleased to be with you today. By way of introduction, my name is Tim Benz. I am president of the Minnesota Independent School Forum. So we're the largest statewide organization representing the non-public schools in Minnesota. I also, as you've said, have the privilege of serving as chair of the Non-Public Education Council for the Minnesota Department of Education. I'm here to provide testimony on the impact of distance learning for the 450 non-public schools in Minnesota, educating more than 65,000 students. For context, the average size of a non-public school is 144 students, and the median size is 89 students. In fact, there are more than 100 non-public schools located in the legislative districts of the members of these two committees here today. Like our partners in the public schools of Minnesota, distance learning has been challenging. Yes, there are examples of schools pivoting on March 16th to their online and virtual platforms and moved right into their learning systems right away. For some, it was the culmination of years of planning made necessary by our periodic closures due to Minnesota snow days. But as Governor Walz said on March 15th, this was not just another snow day. However, for others, it was not all systems go. First and foremost, and many of you have mentioned this today, the teachers missed their kids and they missed their colleagues. I received a call from Mary Gangelhoff, a principal at St. Mary's in Sleepy Eye, indicating they are not a one-to-one school and many students in their rural area did not have adequate access to the internet. Mary said they were working with a local busing company to get assignments and packets out to their students so they can complete their work. This is also an area that had a large canning plant closure last year, thus impacting their entire school community. Following the death of George Floyd, I communicated again with Russ Gregg, head of school at Hope Academy. Hope Academy educates 550 students in the Phillips area of Minneapolis. 70% of their student body qualifies for free and reduced lunch. As you can imagine, the trauma experienced by their families was unthinkable. He said to me, "This was the saddest week of my life." Just meeting the basic needs of their families was primary. Distance learning for his students was impossible. The biggest question, similar to everybody today, weighing on all school leaders and educators is what school will look like late this summer and into the fall. One thing is certain, the mental, social, and emotional needs of students will be first and foremost. For many students, school is an anchor in a sea of chaos. That is why during the previous two legislative sessions, we strongly advocated for specific legislation to expand guidance and counseling services to the youngest learners in non-public schools, grades K through 6, similar to those services available to students in the public schools. In addition, and again noted by previous testifiers, large topics of concern and uncertainty for non-public leaders are transportation, nursing, guidance, counseling, and special education services for students. As you've heard, this pandemic has impacted all students. It is our hope, no desire, that leadership will take the bold step and implement the federal guidance of the CARES Act and ensure services and resources are equitably allocated to non-public and public school students. In closing, I want to share a message that really crystallized the impact of this pandemic on all of us today. I shared this thought with Commissioner Ricker during one of our many conversations over the last 100 days, and I will tip my cap to the Commissioner and the Department of Education on their wonderful partnership and collaboration throughout this period of time. Tom Shipley, who's president at the Academy of Holy Angels in Richfield, sent a note to the school community through all this. He said, "While we are fortunate to not be affected by multiple physical cases, the loss of jobs through layoffs, furloughs, and other job-related interruptions is evident." He continued, "We are not all in the same boat, as is frequently said. In reality, we're all in different boats, but in the same storm." I appreciate the opportunity to testify today. I'm happy to answer any questions that the committee may have, and thank you again.
Thank you, Mr. Benz. And we're going to have we had a little switch around on the schedule. We now have Tom Brenner. He's the principal at Cloquet Middle School, who's able to join us. And then we'll go to Commissioner Rickert and Deputy Commissioner Heather Mueller.
Well, first of all, I just want to thank you all for the time to speak. I did arrive late. I apologize for that. So if I do repeat anything, I apologize. First of all, my name's Tom Brenner. I'm a Cloquet Middle School principal. And we have our problem with distance learning. Just talking about distance learning is our rural access to internet services. We just cannot make it equitable for all our kids and our learning. And I'm very concerned about the models coming out, like the hybrid model, maybe coming back the hybrid model. So kids are still going to go home and not have access to quality educational services if they don't have the same internet services that other kids have. We tried hotspots. Our kids live in such rural districts that even a hotspot does not work for them. And then again, too, some of our families struggle with the platform, struggle with the technology services. So our kids are just not getting the same equal opportunity to the educational services that some kids. And unfortunately, some of our kids who need it the most are the ones who are getting left behind. So that concerns me. And like I said, the hybrid model concerns me in two ways. I'm a little bit worried that if we come back in a hybrid type model, we're gonna come back half days, half the kids are gonna come for a day. And in our situation, I can only bring in a third of our kids because of our size. And we're just gonna have a third of the education happening. We're not gonna move forward. I'm a little concerned that, again, we're gonna come in, teach a lesson, and we're not gonna move forward with our learning processes. And then the kids who go home and don't have the services available at home, don't have the parent guidance, or don't have those types of services to help move them forward, are just going to continue to get further behind. I would advocate for if we go a hybrid, I would advocate for a hybrid online type model where I can bring in my kids who have special needs, who need extra services, where I can bring in my kids full-time who don't have internet services. And those kids who have those accesses, that they stay home and do it online. But the rest of my kids who don't have access to those services come in full-time in a smaller setting. That way I can provide proper education for all my kids at that level. Otherwise, I'm afraid, again, that some kids are going to get more than other kids, you know. Our staff did heroic work over the course of a few months, and I'm afraid they cannot continue that pace. They worked, a lot of them worked from eight to eight. They worked when the kids needed the help, and I don't see that pace keeping up. I don't see how our staff can continue to do that. Again, I'd like to see either all the kids are back and we can service them. If they're not all back, then the kids who need to be here because of internet services or special education services get first access at being back and being back full time. So that is where I'll leave it. And I appreciate all your time. But again, equity is a huge issue that we need to look at for our kids who don't have services. So it's just a huge issue with me.
Thank you, Principal Brenner. That is actually a great place to wrap all the discussion up for our principals and administrators. What we're gonna do is we're gonna move on to testimony from Commissioner Ricker and Commissioner Deputy Commissioner Heather Mueller. I have you slated for 15 minutes, but if you can make it a little bit shorter, that'll give us a little more time for questions and members. It looks like we're going to be able to go till 11:30. So with that, I don't know which one wants to go first, the commissioner or the deputy commissioner.
Good morning still. Hey, I can jump in first and then I'll pass it off to Deputy Commissioner Heather Mueller. I'm going to talk a little bit about our engagement and the feedback sessions we did, and then I'll talk a little bit about the three models we are preparing for fall, or we're asking our school systems to prepare for fall. And then I know the Deputy Commissioner is going to add some details as well. And yes, we will try to go quickly so we can use the bulk of our time for questions as well. So as we've heard since about mid-March, our schools pivoted heroically to provide meals to students, create a meal delivery system to provide school age care for children of our first responders and our critical care workers, and then of course to provide distance learning. In that first phase of distance learning, we learned quite a bit from our school leaders and from our school systems as they were implementing distance learning. And one of the things we realized in that first phase of distance learning, that really that month of April, was that we, as we were hearing anecdotally from students and their families, and the community, we realized we needed a system to make sure that we were getting really good feedback from the entire field, from our educators, from our students, from our families, from the community members who are all pulling together to help support our communities in a myriad of fashions that you know about. And so we actually made sure that in that second phase of distance learning, that first we created an opportunity for high quality professional development between phase one and phase two, that also connected some community experts with our educators so that everybody was getting really high quality feedback on their distance learning plans. We had school leaders sharing, like they did today, a lot of their own surveys with us that they had been doing with students and families. We also made sure to reach out to a number of community members. Our ethnic councils were really helpful in helping us get feedback from families and students, as well as additional community groups. We held a series of listening sessions during that second phase of distance learning with community groups and family and parent representatives. We instituted a distance learning advisory where we were regularly hearing from the field. And then we also made sure that we were using that feedback then to modify our guidance and to improve the sort of support we were giving to the field, and making sure that we were using that then to shape from that distance learning scenario, really our summer learning guidance, which was that option of hybrid or distance learning. And you've heard a little bit about some of that hybrid model already. Then as we were ending this school year, we proposed and we entered into a series of feedback groups. We instituted a family survey, and I will put the link to that family survey in the chat so you all have it to share out to families in your communities. And we also did our own systems review. And so these feedback sessions were organized, and we identified the feedback sessions actually in the beginning of our fall guidance document so that folks could see not only who we received feedback from, but they could see what the questions were and they could see what the actual feedback was to us. And we used that feedback. We worked with the Wisconsin-Minnesota Comprehensive Center to design these feedback sessions. We made sure that the feedback sessions pulled groups together, and we as MDE had a person in the feedback session listening each time, but we were not participating. The participants were encouraged to share their thoughts, provide feedback that would inform our future planning, even if it seemed different from what others in their small feedback groups were sharing, so that we could get divergent viewpoints, so that we could get really rich feedback on the varied experiences of our students, of their families, of our community members, of our educators, of our school leaders, to really make sure that we were determining the sort of high quality feedback that was going to help for our fall guidance. And then let me talk a little bit about our fall guidance. And as you know, we have, everything is on the table right now. We are asking for our school systems to design three scenarios. The in-person scenario being the first one we are asking them to design. In planning this scenario, we are asking schools to create as much space between students and teachers and other personnel as possible during the day. We are also asking that activities and extracurricular programming continuing to follow the sports guidance for youth and adults around COVID-19 guidance, and also making sure that this scenario would be implemented, assuming that our state COVID metrics continue to stabilize and or improve. We also asked them to prepare a hybrid learning scenario where you would have more strict social distancing and capacity limits. In this planning scenario, schools need to limit the overall number of people in school facilities and transportation to 50% maximum occupancy. We would have to cover the sufficient social distancing of at least 6 feet between people occurring at all times, and then making sure that schools could include plans for contactless pickup and delivery of meals and school materials for days that students and staff would not be in the building, as well as implementing school-age care for critical workers. And this, of course, could be implemented if the COVID-19 metrics worsen at a local or regional or statewide level. And it also could be implemented within a school if they experience clusters of cases within the classroom or school. That granularity size is an important consideration in hybrid learning. And then the distance learning model. This is, of course, the one our schools now have the most experience with. Between hybrid and distance learning, because they spent the spring in distance learning. And of course, this is a scenario that could be implemented if local, regional, or statewide COVID-19 metrics worsen significantly enough to require suspension of all in-person learning. And so our schools are working really hard on those three scenarios right now. And in those scenarios, they are addressing how learning would occur. They are addressing how they will equitably meet the needs of our students. This is a piece of our guidance that has not changed. And again, given the feedback we've been getting, it has only been strengthened over time. On March 15th, when we first announced distance learning, we talked about building an equitable distance learning structure. In our summer learning guidance, when we put that out, we talked about how a hybrid model could be used to address those disparities we saw grow during distance learning in the spring. And as our schools start working on or continue working on these three scenarios, whether it is full in-person, whether it's a hybrid in-person distance learning model or that distance learning model, we are again expecting that they are built equitably so that they are addressing those disparities they saw grow. They are addressing disparities they saw were occurring before we even started distance learning. And they are using the decisions they make to structure in-person, hybrid, and distance learning to make sure that they are equitably meeting the needs of our students. And our guidance goes into detail to help them do that. And we have a staff at MDE who is working nonstop with our professionals in the field to also help address some of those decision-making points. And with that, I will stop there for now, hand it over to the Deputy Commissioner, and then we will, of course, stay for your questions. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Commissioner. Deputy Commissioner Heather Mueller.
Thank you, Commissioner, and thank you, Representative Joachim. Thanks for everybody letting us come in and talk with you today, and I really appreciate the feedback that you've heard from our superintendents and charter school leaders and private school leaders, as well as community education, and really giving us a diverse picture of what learning has looked like since March. What I appreciate is what we heard today offered as testimony is very similar to what we heard in the feedback sessions that Commissioner Ricker talked a little bit about. I'm just going to highlight a couple of things. First of all, for the child care and education work group, Aaron Bailey and I have the opportunity to co-facilitate and lead that particular team. And our general focus since its inception in early April has been to ensure that the use of that child care as well as education is not inhibiting our critical workers, and that we are ensuring the continuity of learning and education as in the best ways possible, and looking at the barriers that go with that, especially in a distance learning model. And as you know, some of the pieces that have been identified in the barriers have been really first and foremost the access to internet and devices, as well as ensuring that not only do they have those devices, but they have a sense and understanding of what it is then that once they have those devices, how is it that they're being used and what might that look like. And so we have been working diligently in our work groups and partnering with a number of not only agencies across our state, but also really looking at our educational partners and being thoughtful about how is it that we can grow our resources and also come together in our understanding of what we can do to support students and their families in more of a whole child approach. When we think about our GEARS and ESSER funds, a couple of things that I think are important to note is we really looked at for those GEARS dollars, little over $30 million plus an additional $5 million in grants for other educational entities was set aside specifically to support three areas. First and foremost, technology. And those technology pieces were to help school districts and charter schools round out their access to hotspots, their access to internet devices, and really ensuring that if we were to go back into this model ever, that we have the opportunity for students to have that access. And that it wasn't just one device per family, but it really is one device per student because they are not gaming devices, but they are actually production devices. And I know that from the principal in Cloquet, he did talk about the fact that some of that is still a problem. And I know that you all have talked about broadband and just being thoughtful about how is it you can expand access beyond the use of hotspots and coming out of schools. And so in addition to technology, the second piece we talked about was for summer programming and being really thoughtful and recognizing that a hybrid model will require more in transportation. It could require more in cleaning supplies and PPE, as well as more staff, simply because of the size of the number of students who were allowed to be in a cohort or class, which would be the maximum of 9 students per 1 adult. And then the third piece of that is it looking at how is it that we can support our 0 to 8 and being really thoughtful about supporting the 0 to 8 and outside of not only in support of our community education programs, but some of our other educational partners and nonprofits. And then when we looked at the ESSER funds, as you know, we set aside funds really to target three things. Again, if after you utilized your GEAR dollars, you still have more access issues and or device needs, as a result of that, then you can use your ESSER dollars. Now, those ESSER dollars, as you know, can be used any way you'd like, but we have asked people to really prioritize. First and foremost, would be looking at your technology. The second piece would be really looking at your staffing. And the third is the mental health and support, which are three areas that we heard quite a bit about and are being thoughtful about how it is we're going to be able to support any three of those models as we go in. And we know that we are looking at a number of different avenues also for funding to help to support both a hybrid model and a distance learning model, simply because specifically in the hybrid model, we know the amount that it's going to cost for transportations are going to increase. We also know that the need for protective equipment or PPE, as well as for cleaning device, cleaning supplies are going to increase. And so we are being really thoughtful about some of the other ways that we would be able to access dollars and are looking at ways to be able to support school districts so that that burden is not put on them in a way that they cannot afford. People didn't budget and haven't had the opportunity to budget for any of these instances. I think we're all learning together how it is we can budget creatively, how we can partner in different ways. But at the end of the day, there are some places where we do just need some additional dollars to help to move forward what we're trying to do to support students. And our goal is always to have students in front of their teachers and really being thoughtful about how is it we can create models where they have as much face-to-face time as possible with their educators and with people in the buildings who also care about them. And with that, I will pass it back to Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner Mueller. Folks, we have about 20 minutes for questions and comments, maybe 25. I was going to ask a question, but before I turn it over to Chair Dabney, but I think I'll just put it in the form of a statement. We heard at the beginning from Superintendent Osai the work they're doing pulling teachers to the table with the fall planning, and I just want to throw that out there to make sure that you all are doing the same thing. I think it's important to have teachers at the table and support staff at the table when you're planning your fall programming. So with that, I will turn it over to Chair Dabney to moderate the question section.
every Zoom meeting requires at least one person to start talking before they take themselves off mute. And so I've ticked that off for the committees today. Thank you very much, Chair Joachim. As she indicated, members, we've got about 20 minutes. So while we all love a good preamble and baselining to a question, I'd ask folks to focus in on their questions instead. I'd like to start with Representative Grunhagen.
Can you hear me?
We can.
Oh, thank you, Chair Daphne. I'll just make a statement rather than questions. I appreciate all that the superintendents are doing. Having been a school board member for a number of years, I know how difficult a job they have in front of them. I did talk to local superintendents here in my district prior to this meeting. And of course, we heard a lot of the concerns and things raised. But yesterday I sent out a email to all state representatives. And it's from a scientist who is trained in immunology and microbiology. And she basically argues why schools should reopen without smaller class sizes, social distancing, or face masks. And I'll just read one little paragraph. It says, the science does not support the need for reducing class sizes, social distancing in classrooms or at recess, or the wearing of masks or other PPE. It is deeply concerning that the government, as well as the public health authorities, appear to not have adjusted their COVID-19 strategies to take the account of the large and growing body of scientific data that shows that COVID-19 is not the deadly threat that was originally thought, especially for our children. There are thousands of scientists from around the world, including Nobel Prize winners, doctors, virologists, immunologists, epidemiologists, and microbiologists who have spoken out against the lockdown and any forms of social distancing, with some even stating that these measures should never have been put in place at first. And of course, if we look at the data, we see that 80% of our deaths are in nursing homes and long-term and assisted living. Another 19% is with people with underlying health problems. Now, regardless of which scenario we take, there's going to be problems. But I think opening schools will address the major academic problems and even health and safety of our schools. And to continue this distance learning on a wide scale basis is simply going to create more problems and especially hurt the achievement gap and our special ed students. So I strongly encourage the Commissioner of Education to open schools this fall and to allow flexibility of our school administration to deal with people who have concerns, whether they have health problems or need to do some distance learning. But this three scenario thing, according to the superintendents I talked to in my district, is overwhelming, it's confusing, and they're trying to do three different plans and they're not sure which one they should go with. So you're better off taking one approach, which is opening schools based on the data and then allowing the local districts to make modifications where needed to protect the health and safety of individuals who have major concerns. Article just came out yesterday from the U.S. United States Pediatricians Association, and they call for in-person school this fall. They basically say the same thing the article I just referenced says. So we have the National Pediatricians Association, and we have a host of scientists say open school this fall. Again, no scenario is perfect, but I think that'll produce the best results health and academic wise compared to any type of distance learning scenario. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. And for members of the public, Commissioner Ricker in her comments referenced the MDE parent survey link. We've now added that link to the Education Policy Committee website at house.mn. Work your way through the links to the Education Policy Committee. You'll find the link to the survey, and you can do it there very easily. Representative Kreshaw.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. And to everyone that testified, I appreciate that. I know we have a limited time, so rather than going through a full barrage of questions, this is what I'm about to throw out is for the commissioner and the superintendents and school officials. One of the things, there's broad agreement the schools are going to open up. It's just how are they going to open up? There is no way a one-size-fits-all is going to work. There's just no way. And so with that, the biggest thing that I have heard through all of these and talking to people in these communities is we've got to reduce uncertainty for schools. And the largest uncertainty is that MDE has put out will make our decisions after July 27th. So everybody's waiting and holding their breath. Superintendents and Commissioner Ricker, what I would throw out, and maybe there, if there's a commissioner or a superintendent that wants to answer this, why don't we flip this model around and say, we already know schools are going to open up. It's just how. And at each school, that how will be different. So instead of requiring all the schools to come up with these comprehensive plans, of which many of it may be thrown out the door, because I've seen this over years and years and years. We ask schools to do all this work, and then something changes. Why not let the schools submit a plan to MDE and say, this is our plan at an individual level, submit it by July 15th. It gets approval by MDE that says, yep, go forward. And we know we're going to be changing. Superintendent Lutz, I see you in the video. I fully believe you could come up with a plan and a path with contingencies based on how things are going to evolve. But right now, what we're asking you to do is plan for every possible contingency of which we don't know. So why don't we flip this around and just say, schools, you come up with a plan, you do it, and we'll trust you, and we'll evolve and change as things go. So my question is, superintendents and Commissioner Ricker, how can you better improve the communications rather than everyone holding their breath waiting for the other shoe to drop?
Thank you, Representative Kreshaw. Anybody want to respond? Commissioner.
This is Mary Catherine. Yeah, thank you, Representative. Thank you, Representative Kreshaw. I appreciate that because we are working to improve our communication all the time. As I referenced a little earlier, one of the things we learned in the first phase of distance learning was that we needed, that we had been regularly communicating with our school leaders, and we wanted to more intentionally and better communicate with our students and families and our communities. And we've been building that work out ever since. And so one of the things we have also, we started actually before we even went to distance learning in March, is one of the direct communication lines that has been maintained is our school nurses talking with the Department of Health, actually, so that we have public health officials in the field talking to our public health officials with the, you know, that contemporary just-in-time data at the state, to make sure that they're in constant communication. That's happening weekly. We are also staying in conversation weekly with our superintendents. One of the things we also launched in March was an email address exclusively for school leaders, for our charter school leaders and our superintendents to make sure that we were answering their questions in real time. And also just sharing out a Q&A every week. Now it's a weekly call. It had been every night call with our school leaders while we were planning for distance learning. And then we went to calls twice a week during distance learning so that we could continue to answer their just-in-time questions. But as reflective practitioners, we are absolutely looking to improve our communication to make sure that as they're planning for these three scenarios, as we are looking for the data that's coming out of health so that we make a safe and healthy decision for our students, that they are getting that health data as well. So they understand how both the education decisions they are making measure up each day with the health data we're receiving as well.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Pryor, you have a question.
Thank you, Chair Dabney. And actually, it was what Commissioner Rickard was just talking about was just to hear more about how our schools are working with the Department of Public Health and those experts in the field to, you know, there's some understanding that we all have in the broad general public, but there are specific ways that we can, that I know that are more effective for using our best knowledge right now for protecting public health to basically actualize it, make it happen in the classroom, on the buses, and really adapt to it for community. So, and I appreciate that you're talking now about how that communication has been going forward. And I can imagine that whatever is happening now has to probably be scaled up because it isn't like, okay, do your best, but it'll be always continually adapting as we get more knowledge and information about what the risks are and how to mitigate the risks. So, you know, I guess to also know, do we have enough resources in that area? And, you know, because at the end, we as a legislature are responsible for making sure that the resources that we need to keep our students safe and our families safe and then make sure that we are performing education or, you know, offering education to the highest levels possible, that we're meeting those goals and the resources are there to meet both of those goals together. So I guess that's what I'm asking right now is that something that is in place right now, or is it something that we will need to continue to look to how to scale up that part of it?
Representative Pryor, you know, Commissioner, thank you.
Okay, I'm sorry, I wasn't sure if I was supposed to wait to be called on. My apologies, but thank you so much. Thank you, and actually, I really appreciate your framing of it, and that adaptation is actually the perfect framing, right? I mean, like in a learning system, which the Department of Education must be, because the field is a learning system. That adaptation, we have to adapt and we have to determine. This is why I appreciated Representative Precia's question about communication as well. We have to constantly look for where do we improve, where do we build on our successes, where do we fill in those gaps ourselves. And so the communication is one example, and it has become abundantly clear that our school nurses are an incredible asset to our school systems. And school systems that have a complement of school nurses that, you know, are trained in public health, they have been, as you know, anytime I am on conversation with a charter school leader or a superintendent and they're asking a question, invariably they are talking about how they have been consulting with their school nurses, how their school nurses are part of their planning teams, they're leading their planning teams in many cases. So I will say, first off, we have learned how vital school nurses are to this situation. And so that's the first thing, that if you are, if you're thin on those local public health practitioners, you're really feeling it. The other thing I will say I have noticed is that our school leaders have incredible relationships with their county-based public health professionals, who of course have incredible relationships with the Department of Health as well. So often at the Department of Education, we are just pulling together relationships that are emerging or already exist with the Minnesota Department of Health, the Department of Education, our local partner and our school leader and perhaps their local county partner, and determining what a scenario may be or what an answer may be to a question they have, or actually to some of the brainstorming they are doing. And really in the last week, the number of calls I've been on with superintendents and charter school leaders where they are coming up with really creative scenarios for all three scenarios, right? That in-person and how we're going to both adhere to the safety and health of our students and be 100% in person, the creativity of some of the hybrid models, as well as if they're like through that scalpel approach, if they are going to have to go back to distance learning for some segment of their students, how that is going to look different this time, how it's going to look better and be more equitable this time. And so we are making sure that we're keeping those lines of communication open. And then I will just say sort of the broader resource question you asked, and then and I know our Deputy Commissioner has some things to add, so I'll pass it over to her. That is a very real question we are getting every day, all of us at MDE. I'm getting those questions regularly. Our Deputy Commissioner is getting those questions regularly. All of our leaders are getting this question about the true cost of what accommodations look like, as we want to make sure that our busing and transportation is safe. So we want to make sure that personal protective equipment is there. And it's not something districts have generally built into their budgets, or charter schools have generally built into their budgets. But it's real, and it's talked about every day. And in the sort of the sort of funding our schools feel like they would need to make sure that they're creating additional accommodations. Perhaps, I mean, as we've seen, the creativity of using plexiglass or dividers and accessing those things. And some are very permanent structures, some might be very temporary, but they're all going to take the resources to build and to install and then maintain. And then the other thing I would say that actually doesn't get talked about nearly as much as every school meeting a school nurse, and as access to personal protective equipment and transportation, and that is custodial services. Our schools have been managing with custodial services that have an expectation of cleanliness, but there is an additional expectation in this pandemic around sanitizing things, around making sure that bathrooms have enough stations for students to wash hands before and after lunch and in between classes, and that there aren't pinch points. And our custodians are often in charge of all of that. And that is one of those emerging concerns school leaders have about the cost of making sure they can adequately staff a school for the cleanliness and the sanitizing that we expect. And I'll have Deputy Commissioner Mueller add to that as well.
Thank you, Commissioner Ricker. I think that, just to echo, I think a couple of things that Commissioner Ricker talked about is really looking at where we see we're going to have additional costs, especially if we move into a hybrid model and are looking at even school age care and having the opportunity to transport students in who need to be cared for in a distance learning model. We will need to be following the CDC guidance that's been set forward around transportation. And at that point in time, it is looking at having 6 feet of distancing, which on a school bus. And so that would be one person per seat, unless you're in a family, and then you can have multiple students in a seat, but then one seat in between. And so that really takes down buses from about 77 students who can be on a bus to about 17. And so that really changes the percentage of students. And so transportation is a place we see, I think, to Commissioner Ricker's point, we will also see the need for additional student support services. We've talked a lot about the need for school nurses, but also we recognize that mental health is something that's incredibly important, because this has been a traumatic event, not only with what's been happening with COVID-19, but also with the murder of George Floyd and the pieces that go along with that and the impacts of that. We know that student counselors, social workers, school psychologists, as well as school nurses and or in-school therapy might be pieces that are incredibly important. A third piece of that is really also thinking about the professional development and learning for our staff. And so I think the screening and cleaning supplies are incredibly important, but then to be able to not only ensure that we have people who are prepared to use that wisely. If there is ever a time where we need to use our school nurses to do things that are supporting COVID-19 and testing, if we need to be thoughtful about the way that we support our custodial staff in the use of and cleaning differently, looking at how it is we support professionally our teaching staff in the way that has to look different as they're walking into either a hybrid or a distance learning model. And then also thinking about our bus drivers and what that needs to look like differently. And so there are those pieces of transportation, student support services, screening and cleaning supplies, and then finally really around that professional development are all things that we have heard not only from our education partners and staff, but also from our students have talked about that, our families have talked about that. And so those are pieces that we know weigh heavily. So I could anticipate that those are pieces that our superintendents would have also talked about with us.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner. I'm going to try to squeeze one last question in. Representative Erickson, can you be succinct?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
So thank you to all who testified today. And I would have a request that the department send links to what's on the chat and also what you have sent to education policy. Please send that to all of us members because it is not always easy to access in other ways. Next, Rick Keller has had a concern, Commissioner Ricker, that there is not accessibility to on the school websites for guidelines. So I want you to be aware of that. And next, my question would be to you, Commissioner, if the governor is going to insist on hybrid learning, or you as a department, or distance learning, will he not have to then exercise his emergency powers in August, September, and probably even October?
Commissioner?
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Representative Erickson, both for that accessibility note. I've got it written down, and we'll follow up with those links as well. And then we're continuing to work very closely with the governor's office on determining what decisions would need to get made and when. And that is one of the reasons why learning what is happening with this virus in our communities is really so important, because all the mitigation strategies we can employ will allow the safest and healthiest conditions for our students. But to your point about knowing what September brings, knowing what October brings, we're going to continue working very closely with the governor's office to determine the sort of responsible decisions that need to get made. And I don't know if Deputy Commissioner Mueller, you would add to that based on the conversations we've been having through this whole pandemic.
Right. And I think that there are times when we've learned, especially in this pandemic, that there's times as a department where we lead, there are times when we partner, and then there are times when we support. And what we really appreciate is the opportunity to partner with the Department of Health and really making decisions that are based in public health, that are in the best interest of our students and their families. We recognize that school is critical for our students, and we recognize the equity that schools provide, and really being thoughtful about how is it that our approach and the way that we think about this might be is going to really impact not only the well-being of that student and family now, but also the impact of that student and well-being in their future. And so I think that the commissioner's point is accurate in that those are pieces that we're continuing to have conversations with the governor's team, but I don't know that that's something that we could make an assertion on for whether or not those emergency powers we need to continue.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One last question to the commissioner and to everyone. Like you, I'm sure you received hundreds of emails from parents, and it has become clear to me that it is not their responsibility to homeschool. So when directions are given, or guidance as it's called, from the department, there has to be clarity. For example, I have read so many emails from parents about there not being any communication between the teacher and the student. And whether it's online or phone, that has to be clarified in guidance, because these parents are so frustrated. And my heart just goes out to the children of these parents and the parents, because there was not specific clarity or direction in much of the guidance. And I know that you're probably trying to be a little independent, but in times like this, parents need to know, because many of these parents were working and they were also trying to help their children learn. And I swear, I would swear that they didn't learn, because parents did not understand much of what was being sent to them, much less understand our standards. So we need to keep all of this in mind if we continue to do distance learning or even a hybrid model. And I would also encourage you to submit data when you send us links on what you've collected from districts as far as actual instruction and new learning that was taught during this time. Thank you.
Commissioner, any response?
Yes, I'll make it quick, because I see we're at 11:30. And, mm-hmm. and I will say, Representative Erickson, that the subject of those emails is exactly one of the reasons that between the first phase of distance learning and the second phase of distance learning, that we produced about a week and a half worth of professional development that we were delivering virtually to make sure that, because we, as we were hearing deep concerns, and the school leaders on this Zoom can probably share concerns with the maybe not being able to get a hold of a student or not being able to connect with families. And then when there is that connection, just the struggle our students and families were having with distance learning. And so we spent the last week in April and then the first two school days in May with a series of virtual professional development seminars we offered on how to better meet the needs of students based on what we had learned and some of the success stories coming out of some of our districts that had been more successful, and students who have IEPs or 504 plans, for example, some of the success stories of school districts or charter schools that had figured out how to better meet the needs of students learning English as a new language, for example, or some of the work they were doing to better meet the needs of our Native American students, for example. We put, again, about a week and a half of virtual professional development out there statewide. Every one of those sessions was oversubscribed. So we had over 1,000 people sign up. So we had over 18,000 people experiencing it in real time. Now, they are still posted on our website and they've been downloaded since, and then they've been shared since additionally, because we were hearing that same thing. They were hearing about this this struggle to make sure there was a connection, and then what the expectations were in that connection in supporting students so that families did not feel like they had to be, the teacher and the tutor and the translator and everything to our students. So we are going to continue to work on that. And that just one example of how we were reacting to that in real time as well during distance learning. So thank you for bringing that up.
Thank you, Commissioner. Chair Yuki, closing comments?
Yes, I just want to thank everyone for being here today and sharing your thoughts and all the work that you're doing to make sure that we have a continuity of education for our students. I want to thank all those that spoke at the last two hearings as well. We are living in very unusual times right now, and I want to just commend our whole education system for stepping up and for doing the best that they can. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Joachim. Members of the public who were able to observe today, thank you much for tuning in. Special thanks to the good people of the Minnesota House Information Office who make that possible. Thank you to testifiers for taking parts of your day to share the experience of distance learning in your schools and communities. Commissioner, Deputy Commissioner, thank you. And to members of both committees who joined us today, thank you all very much. With that, we are adjourned.